Good evening, everybody. My name's Anthony Giddens, Director of the London School of Economics. Let me welcome you all here tonight. The annual seminar memorial lecture series on the theme of the good society was endowed by six former students of the LSE to commemorate their friendship maintained for more than 40 years. It had its beginnings in the summer of 1949 when Anthony Baird, David Bennell, John Berg, John Grist, Basil Henson, the late Oliver Marston and Alan Milne, who had met once or twice a week during the previous year to discuss their BSc Econ examinations, agreed to hold an annual reunion. They used to meet apparently in the Seven Stars in Carey Street, followed by dinner, and this august series stems from that informal beginning. Sadly, Alan Miller is ill and can't be here tonight. This lecture series has grown to be one of the most important events in the LSE public lecture calendar and has realised the aims of its originators as a positive memorial which might also contribute to and benefit future generations of LSE students. I'm really delighted to welcome Melvin Bragg here tonight as our 1998 memorial lecturer. Melvin is one of the best known intellectual figures in the country, equally at home in academic circles and in the world of the media. He has a distinction accorded only to very few, that of being regularly satirized in private eye. He published his first novel, For Want of a Nail, in 1965. His latest, Credo, was published in 1997. On Giant's Shoulders, which I gather was published in March this year, accompanies a Radio 4 series. You knew, Melvin, that Robert K. Merton wrote a book called On Giant's Shoulders, or On the Shoulders of Giants. You?
I'm rather pleased I didn't.
I'll tell you about it afterwards. It's famous, probably the most famous sociologist of the post-war period. Did a whole long-term study of scientists standing on the shoulders of other scientists and published this book called On the Shoulders of Giants. Melvin has written over a dozen books, including a biography, famous one of Richard Burton, and an oral history of England, Speak for England. He's also worked in broadcasting over a very long time, beginning in the early 1960s. This is a very impressive list. He is currently controller of arts at London Weekend Television, editor and presenter of the South Bank Show, and executive producer of other arts strands. He runs, as everyone here will know, the discussion program Start the Week on Radio 4 on Monday mornings. He is also president of the National Campaign for the Arts. If this isn't enough, he writes a weekly column in the Times every Monday. I'm very pleased indeed that he's recently become a governor of the London School of Economics. Even given his other commitments, he has already brought to his involvement with the school the dynamism which is his trademark. I'd like to express my gratitude to him publicly for this help thus far. Let me welcome Melvin Bragg here tonight. The title of his lecture is British Television and the Culture. Melvin.
Thank you very much. I'm honoured to be asked to give this lecture tonight. The idea is, I hope that this lecture will last about 40 minutes, you never can tell, and I would be happy to take on questions afterwards, if there are any. For many people, television is their culture. The time spent on it, which is 30 hours on average a week, that's spent viewing television, this is far and away more than time spent on any other leisure activity. What people are watching on television gives most of them, in many cases, their entire culture. Stories, news, sport, comedy, education, trivia, personality, drama, and it goes on. Yet, there's a school of thought which sees the time of pre-television as idyllic. In those days, we were supposed to gather around the piano to sing songs, attend local repertory companies, read all the time, and do Morris dancing. Well, not in my house. I'd argue that this is as best a representation of a very small part of English society, and perhaps altogether mythical. Very few people had the resources to do all or even any of the above. Most people spent their free time, such as it was, exhausted or trying other ways to make ends meet. There was some free time, but that tended to be mopped up or absorbed by institutions, especially the church. The fact is that television has coincided with the growth of leisure, and its impact on our culture can't be underestimated. This twinning has resulted in an extraordinary, unprecedented synergy. Even in my own lifetime, through three generations, from my grandfather to myself, and four if you include my son, the time available for doing things outside work, for doing non-work, has increased enormously. And as importantly for most people, the work itself has changed in nature, and this, I think, too, is crucial. My father and grandfather's generation, like most people in this country, did heavy industrial and often manual jobs in coal mines, steelworks, and so on. Whatever it was, they were very tired indeed after a long shift. Such free time as there was mostly for recuperation. Work nowadays does not make such physical demands in most of the country, in most of what we call the Western world at any rate, and this, in my view, is the most important contributory factor to the change in culture. Like the increase in time, the increase in energy wholly changes the context in which culture can flourish. No time plus no energy or low energy equals no culture or low culture, and the opposite, I think, is also true. It's very doubtful whether the leisure of ordinary people in 1908 or 1948 was anything like as widely informed as today's 30-hour-a-week television leisure. Other things were known. My grandmother, for instance, would have lived where we would starve because of a knowledge of hedgerows and plants for food and how to get meat out of a bone and make a meal of offal. And there's a wisdom of community which has gone, but that's an enormous subject, and that remark was no more than a punt. 90 years ago in the UK, for the majority, the world was a restricted place. There's also a school of thought which seems to believe that life post-television has been morally weakened and enfeebled by that electronic one-eyed monster. For a long time, it was thought, for instance, to threaten reading. And reading, of course, unprovenly but categorically, is also virtuous in a way forever denied mere watching. But this contradicts all surveys. Intensification of reading among the widest general public over the last 50 years has coincided with the rise in television, and that's a matter of record. More books are printed in this country than ever before. More books are sold than ever before. We also know from a very recent study in St. Helena that television introduced into a previously non-television society has stimulated reading and stimulated an interest in books, especially among children. While in purely anecdotal terms, it's widely registered the television adaptations of classics inevitably sell more of the classics. Do people read them, they ask. That's what the chronically pessimistic ask. Did they ever, respond the cynics. The realist, whose badge I wear, is affirmative. Yes, they read, who also sat and watched. The connection here, then, is between television and leisure and education. Television, I maintain, far from taking away from the wider education of the country, has in many cases underpinned it and expanded it. You only have to look at the enormous increase in appreciation of classical music due to the work of BBC radio and television. You can also see this in the increased visits to galleries and museums and exhibitions of all sorts, often stimulated by television and certainly not enfeebled by it. Therefore, television and leisure and the widening of the culture have gone hand in hand over the last 50 years. But there's the vexed question or notion of morality. Has television weakened the moral fibre of the nation? It was once, not so very long ago, gravely suggested that scientists had proved that the screen sent off beams which degenerated the brain. It also made you blind and loosened the bowels, no doubt. There are experts who have argued that the business of sitting and watching a television programme is in itself a passive role which, by its very nature, dumbs down the recipient, forgetting perhaps that many people take a book to bed in order to get to sleep. And physically, what, next to a straitjacket, is more physically passive than sitting reading? Still, passivity is a code word for laziness, which is very bad for you, despite the claims of so many accomplished and talented people that they cherish their passivity and laziness, their brooding time. But no matter, we're in military talk here. One anecdotal riposte I can give to that, to television being passive, is that they've never watched television in my house or the house of lots of people I know. We're always answering back, or commentating, or commenting, or running a parallel story, whether it's dramatic or sporting, and I'd guess that we're typical. There's interesting research to be done, about the effect on the brain of different material coming into it. That is to say, is the brain working more interestingly and more invigorating when reading text than when looking at pictures? I suppose this is still an open question, but in my view it depends on the text and the pictures. Some text is very poor, some pictures and their accompanying words and music are fascinating, and of course vice versa. When people talk of the weakening of morality of people through television, they usually mean the easy and obvious connections between what is on television and the incidence of crime. Many, many investigations and millions of useful pounds have been spent trying to prove there's a direct and substantial link between television and crime, especially violence. It's come to very little. The causes of violence among young people are overwhelmingly said to be to do with violence that was done to them, followed by deprivation, poverty, the violence of their peers, and television comes way down the list as a cause. In fact, in one authoritative study, it was shown that violent young offenders watched rather less television than better behaved children, and the television they watched was precisely the same. I would like, though, to see a study of the influence of television police programs on the behavior of the police. The case that television enfeebles the mind, which some quite recently thought literally true, and saps the moral backbone of the nation, is at best unproven, and at worst the wishful thinking of those perpetually in pursuit of simple solutions. For a few, television has been seen from the beginning as anti-culture. This is partly what I would call the Riviera Snobbery Syndrome, or RSS. About 80 or 90 years ago, when it was very, very expensive to go to the Riviera, and only a few people could go, then the Riviera was written about in ecstatic terms as being the most beautiful, idyllic, fantastical, magical place in Europe. As soon as the middle classes turned up, and even more horror, when the working classes began to turn up, the Riviera began to be discussed in the self-assured higher circles in this country as that cesspit around the Mediterranean. In short, when something is available only to the few, it's thought to be marvellous. When that same thing is available to the many, it's thought to be spoiled and on the way to becoming worthless. This, I think, is the Riviera Snobbery Syndrome. There's some truth in this, in that many people obviously trample on an environment and make it different from what it was. But the larger truth lies in the snobbery, I think, and not in the reality. There was, from serious-minded people from the beginning, a real and understandable fear that television would become an inevitable trivializer. This has real substance, especially in the areas of television such as news and current affairs, documentaries and arts programs, where the limitations of time on the screen mean that heavy and complicated matters have often to be compressed into short bursts of time which sit uncomfortably on the subject. I deliberately avoid the use of the word simplification, because some of these documentaries and some of these programs are works which are anything but simple. But they are comparatively short. The length and ease of complication available to print is not, and has not on the whole, been available to television. Therefore, the charge of trivialization carries some weight. It persists, and it needs to be addressed. I think there's a fundamental and harmful confusion about the use of the word television. Let's take the word television and compare it with the word print. Nobody talks about print in the way in which they talk about television. Yet when they talk about television, they mean all of television, everything that comes out of that single multi-replicated box. Print comes through many and subtly varied forms. But print includes the News of the World, the Times, teenage magazines, 1001 sports magazines, all different, 2001 fashion magazines, also different to the discerning eye, pornography, the Budgerigar Gazette, cycling magazines, sports magazines by the dozen, collector's magazines, country house magazines. I could stand here for most of the rest of this lecture and just list the variations of print, and I've not even begun to mention the differences in books from Mills and Boone to Faber and Faber. Therefore, if we use print in the same way in which you use television, then we could think of print too in generalized terms as trivializing. Some print is trivial, some is not. And to complicate further, there's some interesting trivia and some uninteresting, self-labeled, serious matter. It's much more complicated than that, but we have to get away from the blunt use of television as a word and as a concept which is taken to represent one thing and that thing a common denominator. It's not. If you look fairly at television and judge for yourselves, I think you'll agree. Television represents a multitude of different things. Cilla Black's remarkable and remarkably long-lasting program is one thing. David Attenborough's remarkable and remarkably long-lasting career is another batch of programs. It won't do, at least among people who are trying to make any sense of this, to dismiss the whole lot as mere television. It is, it seems to me, in fact, rather an expression of fear. Television is undoubtedly massively influential, and people, especially people who also seek to be influential, are worried about this. One way to blank it off is to call it mere television. It's interesting that the diminutive most often employed is the telly, as if it can be tamed by turning it into a baby word. It's even more interesting that there are still people in this city, and I would guess in other cities in the country, who are prepared to boast that they never watch television, as if we should somehow give them an extra degree or even a doctorate because of this essential proof of their intellectual superiority. The cultural political power has always been in the hands of the few. It's been of great benefit to the few, deciding on what's valuable and why it is valuable and who has access to what is valuable. Culture has been an instrument of finance, an instrument of state, and an instrument of control. Governments have used culture, the church has used it, and markets have used it. The simplest example to give at the moment is the way that the art markets are, let us say, not manipulated, but clearly organized by men and women who make a great deal of money by switching investment in taste from one esoteric area, which is then allowed to become a little general, so that the middle class money can come in, to another esoteric area, which again the new Riviera people have to run after. There is not only deciding what is valuable by the markets, but we know from the past that in the church and in the authoritarian state, they also like to decide what is valuable. They want to close down the culture. In this time in our country, I think New Labour wants to open it out. Hitherto, the state has decided, for instance, that Grand Opera is valuable to the tune of many millions of subsidy a year, and that, say, folk music or jazz, both of which need subsidy as much as the opera, are not as valuable. This is a state decision, and we mustn't flinch away from the consequences, nor from challenging them. Similarly, it's the state which has decided that certain forms of dance, particularly the classical ballets developed in Russia and as largely inherited from the Tsar's court to the present day, should be given the heaviest subsidies across all the varieties of dance. These are, they have been, the decisions of the few. They too need to be examined now and even challenged. Television threatens this few, this elitist monopoly. The great power of television is that it is like a tap. You just turn it on. Everybody has one. There's no fuss. Or it's like the switch by the door. You flick it on. No big deal. Everybody has an equal switch. They're not barred from it by reasons of geography or psychology or education or even to any great degree at all, finance. Television, therefore, says to elites, you have a limited value. We can bypass you, which is worrying for the elites. In that sense, television is democracy to what has been an extraordinarily resistant and successful crypto-feudalism in arts control and arts direction throughout Europe for a very long time. Less in this country than in many others, but still quite clearly in evidence here. Television has irritated the establishment even more by being able to create, in a very short time, its own indisputable areas of excellence. Take television drama in this country, for instance. Plays by Dennis Potter, or Alan Bennett, or Harold Pinter, or Anne Bleasdale, or Tom Stoppard, or Linda LaPlante, or Faye Weldon, and others for television. Television soaps, I'd maintain, like Coronation Street or The Bill. Television costume dramas of Jane Austen and George Eliot, and television films, especially made for television by Channel 4, all these have, over the last 50 years, at least equaled, and in most cases outflanked, the run of offerings of theatre plays and British feature films that come from the older and more established cultures and receive, in many cases, substantial subsidy. And substantially more critical attention from a press worried about television for its own reasons. The press sees television as a rival. So why should it give television a good press? On the whole, it feeds off television, but also bites the hand it feeds off whenever it can. And that, in a way, is perfectly understandable and fair dues. Yet the character of our culture is still such that, in my view, television is regarded as the second division, or the nursery slopes, which is damaging, I think, for both the television and for the culture. It's always damaging not to recognize something for what it really is. And the way in which those still in power and still in control of matters in this country turn their faces away from television's achievements and can still afford a snigger is unhealthy, I think, and unwise. Unhealthy because it misses the point and fails to see where the energy is. Unwise because this is a tide whose time has come and will not be denied. In my view, television is the great hope for the future of culture. As a transmitting system, it is nonpareil. We know this from live television pictures, for instance. We know that literally billions of people across the globe saw the funeral of Diana, Princess of Wales. We know that billions of people saw what happened in Tiananmen Square. We know that the Cold War came to an end as much through radio, principally, but also through television, as through economic exhaustion. We know that that little box can be an enormous force. We also know that in many countries, including our own, it has been damagingly held back by many things, but chiefly, in my contention, by the limited number of channels hitherto available. I confess that I've been on the conservative side of this argument for many, many years. Rather comfortably and perhaps smugly, I thought that two channels were enough, not so long ago, then three or four channels, and then surely five were rather more than enough. And I was wrong. To go back to an earlier illustration, imagine going into W.H. Smith or Dillon's or Menges and discovering only five print things. I don't mean only five different newspapers. I mean only five print things in total. In those five print objects would have to be crammed all the magazines and books, all the newspapers and journals, pamphlets and so on, that we see in their variety in multitudes on the shelves today. It's quite difficult to get your mind around it. It seems absurd. It certainly seems unbearably restrictive and intolerable. But that, in a sense, is the situation in which we've lived with television for many decades. In terrestrial television, we were content for decades to have only two or three or four television channels. This inevitably meant that in many areas, generalization became the principal craft. Sometimes it became an art. In some cases, it became an excuse. But that excuse is now over. In the area I'm interested in, I've worked in for many years, for instance, in the arts, it's typical that the successful programs have all been the general programs, whether they've been Omnibus and Arena on the BBC or the South Bank Show on ITV. But general programs can only make small inroads into any particular area. So few in a run of, say, 20 or 25 programs a year. So few opportunities for poetry, perhaps two a year, or classical music, perhaps two or three. But all that, I think, is over. The future is 200 or even 2,000 channels, and the future is more or less with us now. Frankly, I used to dread this. I've spoken on public platforms, now and then, in fear and trembling of this. I was a nursed and subsidized Reithian, cosy, duopolist baby. I'm very glad at last to be able to grow up, as I think it is, at the LSE. So let me focus on arts programs and television and the culture for the last part of this talk. At last, I see on these many, many channels the possibility of television and the arts coming together in a way which means something for both of them and something massive for the viewing public. There are two or three general arts programs washing around on cable television at the moment, and they're not doing badly, but I don't think they've gone anywhere far enough. With 2,000 channels, we will be able to afford a dedicated book channel, say 4 hours a day, repeated two or three times, a dedicated opera channel, a dedicated ballet channel, a dedicated painting channel, sculpture channel, classical music channel, and so on. We'll be able to meet the niche and particular consumer demands every bit as much as print can. Your televisions could be the same as the hundreds and the scores of different and variegated magazines you see in one of those huge shops at the railway stations. What television has lacked in this country since it began is a consistent opportunity for steadily developing niche broadcasting. Niche broadcasting has been there. It's been slotted in now and then into a general pattern. It's been hammocked between general broadcasting and taken on a general philosophy itself. But these niches, when released, I believe, onto channels of their own, and when properly funded and presented, could work extraordinarily well. Take an example to one side. Look at football. The audiences for football, except on rare occasions, are comparatively small. You'll all be surprised to hear that very often, or most often, the audiences for football on Sky television are below those of the South Bank show, which goes out very late on a Sunday night for an hour and is sometimes quite demanding. Yet, because enough people want to watch football and enough people are willing to pay for watching football, you have an extremely profitable channel, an extremely profitable niche channel, and I think that it's improved in many ways the game of football for viewers at the games and watching the game, and I think that's the harbinger for us all in the future. What we must do, we who work in television and believe in it, is to persuade those who control the finances and who are running the current system that there's a profit in niche. Those who run the finances are men and women. They're by no means philistine, and they want to develop television cable channels. They want to find new markets. For too long, we, and by we I very much include myself, have gone along to them saying they ought to help the arts because the arts are such a good thing, a sort of charity in short. I think there's no ought in cable television. There's no ought there anymore. It's a profit-making enterprise. But I think we can prove, or rather I hope we can prove, that these niche channels could make a small profit, but if there are enough small profits, it could add up to something quite substantial. The analogy has got to be print again. You look at all these magazines on the racks, and many of them, not all of course, but many of them are making money on sales whose figures in television terms hitherto have been derisory. They're selling 40,000 copies, or 70,000, or up sometimes up to 110,000, or even 150,000 copies, and many of them making comfortable and sometimes very pleasant profits. These figures, any of those figures, add all those figures together in British television terms until now, have scarcely even registered on the collecting system of figures. They get less than the test card gets. They simply, in television terms hitherto, have not mattered. Yet, if we could finance the cable channels in such a way and do programs effectively and economically, as we are now learning to do, that, say, 150,000 people would subscribe to an opera channel and pay, say, between £10 and £15 a month, then this could well be profitable. For their £10 or £15 a month, they could see not only see operas, there could be offers of free tickets, trips, competitions, CDs, special rates, and so on and so forth. The intermeshing from the music industry, the opera industry, if one might say so itself, and television, and the public, between those three, the synergy could be very exciting indeed, and I think that applies right over every area we're discussing, whether it's books, theatre, dancing, or whatever, right across the arts. What it needs most of all at this stage, and what it needs desperately, I think, is for someone, somebody, to do sufficient research to work out if this kind of development could lead to some profits. I think that the age of seeing television arts hammocked and subsidised because it is a good thing, I think that age is coming to an end. It's even under threat in subtle ways inside the BBC itself. It has to fight its corner now, as we have to do over at the South Bank show in the arts department inside Granada. We have to make a profit. We're also, I admit, supported there in some ways. It's not a fundamentalist free market, but at the same time, it is not in any serious way subsidised. Perhaps cable could be part of what is now becoming known as the third way. If research could be done, and I think it could be, to prove that cable channels, say channel 1800 to channel 1900, those 100 channels could be niched into specific areas of our culture, then television could revivify the old cultures, re-energise new cultures, use its technologies to reach out to those who trust those technologies and who wish to relate to those technologies, who find pleasure in those technologies, and take on something from which, in a sense, it has been excluded. That is to say, a full and important role as a transmitter and creator in the widest possible culture of this country. The future, in a sense, lies with many of the young people at the LSE and institutions like this. All bright young people today who are moving into the various areas of influence, maybe even power in the land, wherever it be, in politics, in corporations, maybe in the media itself, are they interested in taking television seriously enough to feel that they could back this and develop this as an option? I don't think this is a vaporous remark to bring the talk towards an end. I know that many of my acquaintances in America have simply given up television, and this has been disastrous for television. Of course, in certain areas, most notably comedy, they have anything but given up for internal, commercial, and structural reasons. That's where they are very interested in television, and as a result, American television comedy at its best is absolutely brilliant and extremely original. But across whole areas of television, they have just walked away in a sort of disgust from it. Some of them are finding themselves again on niche channels, the Discovery Channel, for instance, and the History Channel, but it's a slow process. We also know that in state-controlled and authoritarian countries hitherto, intellectuals have walked away from television because they've felt there's no place for a free voice. And so in many places in the world, intellectuals, thinkers, those who set the tone of society, opinion formers as they used to be called, have not taken television seriously, or they have been afraid of it. This is understandable, but it's a great pity. And if it continues, then television will not take itself seriously. It will be left to those who wish merely to exploit it. Yet at the same time, it will continue to grow and influence and spread its influence to capture the hearts and minds and imaginations of billions and billions of people. So it seems to me, finally, there's an opportunity here, and an opportunity which in this country we're well placed to take full advantage of. And that's to go to the next stage of television, to take television from its generalist present, in which many fine things have been done, to its specialist future, in which even finer things can be done. Thank you.
Do you want to come and sit?
If you want, yes, sure. Fine. Thank you.
We've got 10 minutes or so for questions, of which there seems to be at least one pressing. So
I think you have to speak up, probably.
My name is Jim Kennedy. I am not being dismissive of television, and I don't belong to the RSS Brigade. Indeed, you pointed out some problems about television, some of which I would suggest are being better coped with by radio, Radio 4 and BBC World Service and so on. Now, let me speak up. That some of these objections that you acknowledge, problems about television, like trivialization and so on, I think are being overcome to quite an extent by radio, by BBC Radio 4, the World Service, that sort of thing. And it's interesting that your own excellent show, Start of the Week, albeit somewhat recently somewhat truncated, appears on radio rather than on I would like to share your optimistic view fully about the multiplication of channels. But would you comment about two questions concerning television? First of all, what is going to be the effect of the internet on television? And secondly, are you concerned about the increasing concentration of ownership? Is there a possibility that within this so-called diversity, we will in fact wind up having, in real terms, fewer nations and merely sort of increased commonality with only slightly enhanced particularity? So the two points.
Yeah, the two massive points. I don't know what the influence of the internet is going to be on television. I think that they can exist in parallel. I don't think that the internet is going to eat into television any more than television ate into reading. That's about the most I can say in any succinct manner. I don't think it threatens television. I think there'll be an intermeshing which will might benefit both, but that's being perhaps a bit too panglossian. But I certainly don't think it'll affect the base of television as we know it now, which for a foreseeable future will be a lot of people want to watch it more of the time than they seem to want to do any other leisure activity. I can't see it, nor can any projections that we know see that changing very much. And to do with the concentration of ownership, well, that's a, when communications, when any system gets massive and powerful and rich, which the media in the world is increasingly, and we'll, the only thing we know about the media, well, we don't know this, but one thing that is a common assumption is that it's going to get bigger, and all the young people who are going into it are very wise, seems to me, because it is going to expand and grow. It's at least as good a bet as anything else going at the moment. When these things happen, monopolistic influences and urges take over. But there are regulations which hold that in check in America. There are regulations which hold that in check in this country. And certainly in certain European countries, they hold it in check. I think that that's a balance between how countries can fight to regulate this and how much the big international corporations can get away with it. That applies right across everything we're looking at, not just television. It will just be part of that. But I don't think it's entirely hopeless. So I don't fear in the way... I think there's a lot of fear about television. I think that's one of the things that's holding it back. I think that one of the things that's maybe holding a lot of people back for putting their heft into it is because they think that the thing will take over. Either it's going to... There just seems to me... people will correct me in this audience and say... There seems to be two perceptions. One, that it's far too powerful. And the other, that it's far too trivial. And these neither of these get us anywhere, it seems to me. I think if we go somewhere in between, it'll find an effective place. And I do actually believe what I said. I do think if television can break down and still hold the big general programs, the big market, still hold the thing for the 30 hours of leisure to be watched on television, break down into these single channel cultural things, I mean, then I think it'll be an enormous benefit to people. Just imagine, for people who like opera fanatically, and when we do a program about opera, we get letters which show enormous information and knowledge people want to. Now, we can do maybe two of those a year, if we're lucky, because of money and because we only have 20-odd slots and so on and so forth. Imagine a dedicated channel where 7 days a week, say 4-hour spells, you can see not only opera, but rehearsals and backstage stuff and history of and individual singers coming out. You have enough people, would find that to be an enormous benefit and addition to their lives, like some people find parts of Radio 3, and so it goes. And that's all available through cable now. We didn't have the distributing systems to do it. It's available now. What we've got to be able to do, which I think is very difficult, is to prove, and I think this is essential to it. I mean, I'm a Labour Party man, so it's an odd thing for me to say, but prove that there is a profit in it. I don't think we're going to get anywhere by going around saying, this is a good thing, so you really ought to do it. I think that argument's flat now, doesn't work. But if you can prove that there is some profit in it, and I think it is provable, I hope it's provable, then I think it could change people's lives substantially, as a lot of people think that Radio 3 has changed their lives substantially. Access to the range of classical music they never dreamt of before they had this facility.
Broadcasting. So, for example, take documentaries and universities are not the same. But by calling them all universities and relativizing them, you can kind of try and do a con. I wouldn't want to see that happening in culture or within TV culture. And of course.
Well, there are about 17 questions there, really. But I tried to pick through it. I think the question of dumbing down is one that has to be addressed in detail, because it's every generation says it. You know, every generation says that, you know, the politicians of the last generation, you know, what grand figures they were of the past, great speeches. Oh, what grand figures back to Lloyd George. Oh, Lloyd George, what grand figure before this pipsqueak turned up. Look at Gladstone and Disraeli. Oh, there, look back to Peel and Castlereagh. Where we go, Pitt and away. You can do that in culture all the time. You can do that in television. As a rough and ready guide, I would think two things about current terrestrial television, the four, well, if you include Channel 5, I think that slightly alters the mix. I think you'll find about as many serious-minded programmes as you would 10, 15, 20 years ago. But I do agree with you that there is greater pressure now on ratings in all the channels, including BBC, than there's ever been before. And this does result in certain areas being looked at in a way which they would not have been looked at before. Now, when I've noticed John Grisley in the audience, when I joined the BBC and he was running a programme called Gallery on the BBC, a very high-level political discussion programme, for instance, I bet, and I would just take a bet, I'd bet, you know, this building on it, the word ratings didn't come into his mind or anybody else's mind. It just wasn't, not because that wasn't what the enterprise was about. Now, that is what the enterprise is about now. That is part of it. You can't do question time even without also talking about it. That is a new pressure. You're absolutely right. And that has had consequences. And you may be right. There may be, although you've got to be careful about these things, there may be a direct consequence in documentaries. Now, fly on the wall is a very interesting technique and can get you a long way. Fly on the wall and nothing else can become banal, trivializing, and actually prevent you doing the sort of investigative journalism that is long and hard and often doesn't come off, and a lot of failures along the way. So that goes some way. The second part of your question, as I remember, I'm not saying that by going for these dedicated channels, you drop the general channels. I actually think they'll reinforce them. If you don't mind me just using the South Bank Show as just an example, we're a general programme. You know, when we do a programme about Kiritikanua, my ambition is to make Pavarotti, it's a programme that Pavarotti will respect, I mean, literally, but also that people who know very little about opera want to watch and go along with. That's a generalist ambition. That's what you're trying to do, and trying to make it obvious as well as you can. I think those programs have got to continue for precisely the purpose you say, because of this great hoovering possibility and this great hoovering talent that television has. It undoubtedly has. It just brings in people from all over the place who would never otherwise have clicked into that sort of thing. Look at the nature programs, for instance, and so it goes. That's got to stay. I actually think if these dedicated channels grow, they will reinforce this, because people will grow more used to watching this stuff through television. One of the problems television and the culture that I'm talking about at the moment has is that it enters people's lives so little. You know, the culture of music comes through CDs, the culture of literature comes almost entirely through books, and maybe a bit through the radio, and so on and so forth. If television can also be part of a general distributing and consuming system, sorry to use these words, I'm not very at ease with them. But still, then I think it can reinforce the general programs. Otherwise, I do think that television will be badly underused. I do think we'll be missing a great opportunity and we'll be failing to deliver what we could deliver. But I don't think the two are against each other. I think that they will reinforce each other. The first thing I've learned about the LSE is that nobody asks one question. Right. That's right. There you go. First of all, the question is, why did I make a U-turn from leaving two or three channels to Manchester? Secondly, how is the BBC going at the moment? Because I'm being a bit defensive.
Well,
how would it fit into that? Well, as for you, I don't think it was a U-turn. I think it was simply, I mean, I'm basically, temperamentally, I mean, rather like Norman Mailer described himself as a left conservative. I think Malcolm Lowry did as well, interestingly enough, and they're both writers I admire massively, and that would be rather my position. If I think something's good, I hold on to it. I think Cumberland's good, so I've lived there all my life, and I still have a place there, and so I've stayed with the same programme for over 20 years. And so I thought that these channels were delivering very strongly, and why did you need anything else? Then two things happened. We're going to get something else, whether we like it or not. So that's that. You know, the weather's changed. You can't do anything about it. There it is. And secondly, when I began to think more about it, I saw the opportunities and the possibilities. And therefore, it behoves my generation, who's in a position of some influence and had so many benefits, to try to drive towards pushing it through to the next generation. And the next generation is us, terrestrial, plus all the rest. To go back to the previous questioner, it's having a broadsheet newspaper, let's say The Guardian, plus all the section of The Guardian pulled out and given their own special niches all around the place, which is what happens in print. And television, it is now possible to do that. It was inconceivable. I mean, I couldn't get my mind around it. People kept saying there'll be 200 channels, 2,000 channels, and I kept saying, yeah. It didn't matter. But now they're here. And now you can address them. So that's the U-turn. It's because it happened and because I saw possibilities. I think the BBC is in this country is a talk on its own. It is, I do believe, the cornerstone, and must be defended and looked after. I worked for it in radio, and I was trained there, and I'm a frank friend of the BBC's. Sometimes at the moment I'm very worried about what it's doing to itself. I'm very worried about its forays into commercialism. Is that going to take it in the right direction? Is it or not? I don't know. I wish that somebody did have a blueprint that would tell me. I'm very worried about the fact that the BBC is throwing everything into a ratings war with ITV. I can see the justification, the Hugh Carton Green justification at the beginning of the 60s, that when ITV came in and slaughtered the BBC's audiences, that the BBC had to get a lot of people watching for some of the time. And therefore, you had to do popular programs so that the license fee payers, which is everybody, got their two penneth, you know? I think that's still a good policy, but wanting to do the lottery show, pinching ITV ideas and having police series against police, you just think, hold on. So there's a great worry there, and I think there's a greater worry there than there's ever been before. On the other hand, the BBC still turns out some wonderful programmes, and so it's a place where you can make very good programmes, and that's, in my view, it's some of its programmes. So I think the BBC is a worry. I also think the BBC is an anxiety in a larger economic and political context. How long do people want to pay a license fee when quite a number of them soon might not be watching television on the BBC all that much? They'll be watching television on other carriers, other channels. That will become a political question. And it would be wonderful for a certain unscrupulous party to say, and one of the things we'll do is you won't have to pay £120 a year, which will be by then license fee. We're going to abolish all that. So there's that possibility as well. I think the BBC has to be, eternal vigilance to keep the BBC going. It's a major cultural force in this country, but it's now, I think, probably it's as threatened as it's ever been, and I think the threat is going to grow, not because people are menacing, but because the way the thing is moving just diminishes its position. Look at radio, BBC Radio. Not very long ago, BBC Radio was radio. Now, BBC Radio is less than 50%. That is inconceivable 25 years ago, but there it is. And these things have consequences.
Someone might disapprove the generalisation, people, as you always ask two questions.
The main threat, or I am a lesson graduate.
But you have to speak up a bit.
Okay. I have one simple question. When I hear about 200 to 2,000 channels, and that's a question of availability of product, I just returned from living. They have over 100 channels for radio. One of them transmits all day the sound of running water. And the other one transmits all day the sound of silence.
Which you do need in Tokyo, I do.
Public service. Sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The availability of product for so many channels.
Well,
again,
I refer you...
of dumbing down.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, we're all too frightened. I mean, go into a railway station, which I do when I go to Cumberland, go into Euston and see that railway what's it called, shop, where they sell, newsagents. There's millions of the things, of magazines, and they're doing all sorts of things. I don't think they're dumbing down. There's intellectual magazines at all levels. There's cycling magazines at all levels. There's, if you're interested in this fashion stuff, they seem to go round the corner and back around. I don't think it's dumbing down. You know, I really don't. I don't think there's a limitation to the capacity for people to take in information. I think what's been proved, if anything, as much as anything in the last 20 or 30 years, is that it is almost boundless. On and on it goes. I don't think that multiplication means dumbing down. It can mean dumbing down, but in itself it doesn't mean dumbing down. Well, if I knew answers to that, I would sign up with Mr. Murdoch and really rule the world. I don't know how they're going to affect radio at all. The only thing I can say is people are very selective about what they listen to and what they watch. All this thing will happen is they will have a chance to be more selective. Now, there's nothing too terrible about that. And they will be more selective. The amount of hours watched won't go on television, by all research says it won't go more than 30 hours a week. But people will take it from different channels instead of taking it from two of their favourite channels and that sort of thing. How it'll affect radio, I don't know. I just heard a gentleman saying there are 100 channels in Japan, including one doing running water and the other doing silence. People will switch around. I actually don't see that this is necessarily a bad thing. I think it makes it, I don't think it even makes it difficult for the viewer and listener. People get the hang of these things very quickly, especially the newer generations get that. They know where their music is, they know where their sport is, they know where their thinking is. I think in a sense, by holding back, by being fastidious, by being fearful, we're not getting in on the act. And getting, because what's going to happen is the first two or three years are going to be, 4 or 5 years are going to be terrible teething troubles. Getting them there, getting them down, so they're part of the deal. They're part of the landscape, which I think that we should be as soon as is humanly possible, so that we're not snootily not part of the culture. We're right in it. One of the things I do regret about the BBC, very much, but you know, it's too late, and I think there's another way around it, is that the Reithian concept, which is overused, but I think it's still a very noble idea of the hammocking, of leading you from something in which you were generally interested to something which had a particular interest, but you would stay with it. That is being streamed away in radio. And I think that's deeply regrettable. I think that, you know, having special, the BBC is already going, in a sense, for niche radio channels. And I think that is sad and that's regrettable. But that's maybe the days of that are over, because that's generalist broadcasting. By coming in specialist broadcasting, that might be another way to get at it.
Do you want to pick a person this time?
No, you can do that. You're very good at that.
Well, I was going to pick right over the very back there. Yeah,
against the specialist channels is all very nice.
You have to speak up though.
Well, now you put your finger on a problem. Who's going to pay for it? And initially, in my view, the consumer will have to pay for it, and that will put an economic limitation on it. There's absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever. But then what will happen, I think, in America, where cable sells you packages and give away the channels that don't make any money, and I presume that the culture channels are never going to make much money, they'll give them away with a package if you buy as a cable consumer the popular music channel and the sports channel, you also get from this particular station 55 channels about culture. I think that will come about. But in the beginning, I think it will start with a low base audience, and they will be people who can afford to pay. In the idea that I have about the way it's going to move forward, I hope I'm wrong. Maybe somebody will move in faster than that. But yes, I think that. Yeah, you're right. But I'd rather, risk that than not do it at all. Well, one thing we're doing, actually, as, and this is not not being sycophantic, is Granada, through Tony Giddens, Granada and LSE are attempting to come together, and we've had a couple of fruitful meetings, which we hope will develop, to do the first thing necessary, which is to do some substantial research which will convince the people who run Granada Television that there is something worth running with here. I think that's the first step, and I don't think it need take massive long time. Once we've got that, we can take it to people, and we are taking it to people who are hungry to start new channels. As somebody said earlier about Japan, they need material for new channels. So we're offering them what they want, that is material for new channels. But I do think we have to prove that these aren't channels of charity, that these can make something of a go of it. And the first thing that needs to be done badly is research. But you see, just to take heart, just to take heart, nobody in this country thought that a football channel would work, you know. Things change so quickly. Nobody, except maybe two or three people, but in any general sense, nobody thought that people would pay for football. They thought there was enough football on television, there was enough football on Saturday afternoons anyway at the pitches. Nobody thought they would pay. Well, I think research is the way to translate it. And I'm not suggesting losing the terrestrial channels. These are an addition. No, there's more money. Well, there's more money for Channel 4, Channel 5, cable channels, Sky Television. There's more money. It's a rich technology, all this.
My name is Walter Elk, and I'm also a graduate of this institution. I have no problem with your, or no great problem with your general theme about niche television. But wherever I've been in countries where there has been multi-channel television, as in America, I noticed that as I worked my way through the channels from number 1 to number 34 or whatever it is, what appears on the screen is quite extraordinarily alike. And in the end, I got to switch off. And given your emphasis, which I'm sure is right, that the thing has to be profitable, isn't there a danger that the only thing that really is profitable is what has been shown to be profitable in America, namely the
Well, that's a pessimistic view, and you may be right. I hope you're not. I think you're not, but some would say that's a realistic or pessimistic view. So what do we do? Do we just give up and let the Philistines take over? I don't think they're being niche enough. My argument is that when you switch across American television, which like you, I do, and end up at 2 o'clock in the morning in Ohio watching Alan Bennett's Talking Heads on some public service channel, which is what seems to happen to me most of the time. When you do that, it's because you're hitting channels which haven't worked out the niche possibilities. Now, I don't think it's fair to compare American television in the cultural area with ours. They haven't developed in the same way. We have a completely different tradition. We have a completely different 40 or 50 years experience. And we can build on that. Our experience has shown that documentaries, arts programs, serious current affairs programs can hold a good big minority audience, a substantial minority audience, and hold them through decades by doing serious work. And what I'm suggesting is developing on the back of that and finding out if there are customers for it, literally customers for it. We know there are customers for instance, when they did Madame Butterfly at the Albert Hall. It was sold out in 10 minutes. Well, those 7 days, literally was. You couldn't get a ticket after about half a day. There's people want to feed on the things that they like in these areas. And I do think you can actually find a way to discover whether a comparatively small number in television terms would be prepared to put some money there. I suspect that they might. Well, I think we need regulations for the major terrestrial channels. I think you need a much lighter touch for the sort of channels I'm talking about.
Yeah, but some.
Well, you need to make sure it keeps the laws of the land and that sort of thing, but I don't think much more than that. But I'm making it up as I go along at the moment. I mean, nobody knows what's happening in here. Well,
in the
meantime,
the BBC and its ratings battle has virtually gone right down, you know, in the quality of what it produces. But that's not.
Well, I'm in that case, I failed tonight, and I'm very sorry, because you know that that I respect you, and I think that you have not taken on board what I've said, and in that case, that talk's been a washout. The actual programmes that I do. Go on about the South Bank Show programmes, but since Christmas, Julian Waring, Hume, all that sort of stuff, there's some very good quality stuff there. We have tried, and many, many people in British television try hard to do quality. That's point one. BBC, I don't think the BBC has gone down the drain. That's defeatist. I don't think it's accurate either. That's point two. But more importantly, I wasn't talking about diminishing quality. My whole point was, you take the best of opera, the best of dance, the best of books, the best of poetry in that, you take those onto what I call niche channels to give people more of this. I thought I was increasing access to more quality for more people. I introduced the idea of profit simply because of the difficulty we have in this country now, and certainly the difficulty worldwide, of invoking subsidy for these sort of maneuvers, especially if they're to do with profitable technologies like television. It's easy to get subsidy for books and stuff because there's some of them, but not for profitable technologies. I think, to go back to the young woman at the start, I think it could actually spread to a wider public very quickly. That's a side point. But I'm talking about increasing quality work on television channels, putting more and more quality work on television channels. So instead of getting, say, the program we did on Aida with Pavarotti, which anatomized Aida, you did that with every opera and spent 4 hours on it at a time, and then looped that, and you had access to real. That's the sort of programs I'm talking about. And whatever you say, John, that is now available. And if we decide to wash our hands of it and say, no, we can't get involved in that because that's just multi-channel similarity in the States or something like that, then it'll get on very well without us, and we'll have missed a great opportunity. Well, I think there's no certainty because there's no precedent. The nexus to this, the link, the equal sign in my equation is research. Can we find out if 150,000 people subscribing to an opera channel at £12 a month would enable us to run an opera channel that really stood up to scrutiny? Could somebody tell us that, please? And if so, and if you've got a profit return of, say, between 5 and 10%, could I then take that to Jerry Robinson and Granada and say, look, this is worth doing? It takes a year or two to get cracking, but it's worth doing. And there's another 15 like this, And so maybe there's something interesting here. I think that is the next stage. And I think that in the present context, that's the best we can hope for. It isn't too bad either. It means standing a bit more on your own feet than we used to in subsidized television, which I've been in this country, but it's the only way to go forward.
Do you see any contradiction between doing that and at the same time trying to persuade governments of whatever political party to make more funds available for culture
No, I don't, because what we're asking governments to make funds for is culture which is very generally available as near free as possible, or as cheaply as possible. Funds so that lots of people can go to the opera, watch good BBC programmes and so on and so forth. That's for mass, as many people as possible. Here we're talking about specialist audiences. You know, people who like ballet, that will hate the opera, they'll never buy that and so on and so forth. But it's extending the remit. I don't see a contradiction. I don't think if you stop pushing the cable idea, the government would say, oh, they've stopped pushing the cable idea, we'll add another 10 quid to the BBC licence fee. I don't think it works like that. A couple more minutes and I have to pass it. But,
Mr. Chairman, I don't want our speaker to be despondent. His message hasn't got across. I disagree with my friend Lambert. Your message has got across. It's a marvellous message. But you see, we're all want culture, go and buy culture. You want a football match, you pay for the ticket. But it does worry us. I mean, you said you pay for each sort of program. Now, I'm a very poor man, but I have a wealth of interests. So I've got to choose between history and an art or something like that. So one year I have that section of things I like, and the next year something else. It's the cost of it that worries us. The idea is superb. Line that you're delineating, and I really think you should lead this campaign and get a lot of support, but it's got to be backed up by a very reasonable idea of how it's going to be paid for. It may be that modern technology will make it cost less, but at the moment, culture costs a lot, paying for Mr. Burke's helicopter and other things.
Yes, I think large institutions are mopping up money. I think the print analogy isn't bad. And I read history, and I'm still interested in history, so I take history today, and I pay whatever it is a month for that magazine. And if there were a History Channel, I'd pay into that, and so on. And I'm sure you're the same. I do think, I have to come back to this, and I do think you say your LSE economics, it is a very a happy coincidence that literally in the last 5 or 6 weeks, we have moved Granada to LSE and asked them to help us to research this, to find out what the costs are. I mean, there's absolutely no point in discovering, yes, this is possible, and it'll cost £300 a year for every person to have an opera channel. Well, that's not a starter. But if it costs a lot less than that, and you get more people, then it really could be a starter. I think that's a possibility. Look at the number of people who buy into book clubs. It's a very substantial number of people. Now, actually, to produce a book channel on cable channel would be peanuts. It would be peanuts, especially if you gave them a slice of it. The ways that it would be cost you so little money, and yet somebody wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind. I got a 4-hour slab. I got the latest up. Heaney reading some of his latest poems. Howard Jacobson talking about his new novel. Hanif Qureshi defending his new novel. People talking about the biography. Peter talking about Thomas Moore and so on and so forth. If I got that available, it costs very, very little to produce. Very little to produce. Indeed. And so how many people would it cost paying how much to make that just turn over something that could be called a profit? I think that's all we need to know. It's a lot to find out, but I think it's discoverable. And if so, I think we're in business. Well, the lady's had her hand up quite a few times. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, it's a good ending because it's a good, it's again a multiple question, and it's and it sort of strikes the heart of the matter. The answer is I don't know, but the facts are, for instance, it is inconceivable that any cable television channel would be able to offer the team that I work with more wages. Not that they're tremendously well paid, but they just won't get paid more if they move across. It isn't possible. They won't have those sort of, so that's out of the question. Your analogy of cricket is a long and tedious one. I mean, I think with sport, I don't mean tedious for you. I think that the BBC particularly didn't fight hard enough for cricket and football. And they certainly blew the football deal by not coming in with ITV, and they gave it to Sky. But that's another argument altogether. So these things aren't inevitable. I would just come back to two things, really. These channels are here to stay. Our children and their children are going to treat them like we treat the variety of the print. There they are. If the sort of things that most people in this room like and believe in are represented in depth nowhere on those channels, then they won't be missed because they're not there. But I think it will be an opportunity missed. And I think we're in a position now, particularly in this country, because there's still a big force behind that sort of programming, to say to people, will these sort of things work? I actually do think they'll work. I think the figures will add up. And I don't think the cost will be prohibitive. And the gentleman over there said about paying for football. Well, a lot of people are prepared to pay 15, 20 quid to go to a football game, sometimes more. A lot of people, every other Saturday. Some of them go to away games too, so that's every Saturday. You know, if people like things, want them, they're prepared to pay more money than you'd think. And I don't think it's just confined to an elitist view. So I remain optimistic, but most of all, I remain impatient for some serious research to take us to the next stage.
Well, I hope the founders of this occasion are pleased with what was obviously an extraordinarily successful lecture, because we could have gone on for many hours yet. So can I thank Marvin Bragg again very, very much for coming to the LSE tonight. Thank you.